dun, dun, dun. The Razorwise Report, Episode 1, The Tremulous Edition. Hi, everybody. This is Sean Preston, the president of Reality Blurs, and I'm here with my very special friend, Justin Suzuki, our tech ninja, and you can also hear him on The Game's the Thing, Roleplay DNA, and his new show, The Suzuki Chronicles. Did I get all that right?
You did, Sean. Thank you for having me on for this inaugural episode.
Pleasure to have you on.
So.
So yeah, everybody, you can tell I'm a veteran at this.
Yeah, Sean's a little bit new. That's why I think he asked me to be on, so that way I can sort of help move him into the world of podcasting, because he's used to putting his words out in a typed form, not a verbal form. Is that correct, Sean?
Yes, that's absolutely right, Justin.
He's very verbose. So Sean, today, I guess, we're talking about Tremulous, your project that is now kickstarted. It's out there. So I guess the first thing that people will want to hear is, well, first of all, can you sum up what Tremulous is?
Absolutely. And we appreciate everybody finding this show from whatever source they come from. And don't worry, we'll get right down to it soon enough. Tremulous is a storytelling game of Lovecraftian horror, and it's based on Vince Baker's Apocalypse World Engine, influenced by Fate and Fiasco, and is good for beginning role players and old hands like us.
And what and this is what I think is we have found interesting during the playtest is that we've actually had a few beginners, one person who we know, who I don't know if we should mention her name or not.
No.
But one person who has, from what I understand, never played a role-playing game before. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. Yes.
And she's logged about how many hours playing Tremulous now, just in the playtest?
I'd say about 35 to 40 hours.
Which is pretty phenomenal for someone who wasn't role-playing. And, you know, it's not like she's old, but she's not exactly like a 13-year-old who's just coming into gaming. She's sort of just in that point where if you would have picked up gaming, you probably would have done it by now. So I think that speaks a lot towards the game. Where did the inspiration for Tremulous come from? I mean, we know through Reality Blurs you've released other horror products, or at least Lovecraftian products, things like Realms of Cthulhu. Agents of Oblivion has a little bit of that horror influence in it. Where did Tremulous come from?
Well, I was turned on to Apocalypse World by Jason Morningstar at Origins last year. And he and some other folks had been buzzing about it on Twitter. And a few of the aspects of the game, such as fronts, I found very intriguing and thought there was something we could use for potentially some Agents of Oblivion products. And when I started reading it, I started deconstructing the rules and I found something very, very clever within, and I thought it would be intriguing to take it into a Lovecraftian mind space, play space, if you will.
I mean, could you expand on that a little bit? I mean, what exactly was it about Apocalypse World that you felt, and I think I agree with you, but what did you initially say, oh, this part of Apocalypse World would work so well with a game like Tremulous?
In most role-playing games, you have either a clear-cut success or failure. And one of the things that is particularly attractive about horror stories is a lot of times when bad things happen or people attempt to do something and they sort of do it, it's a lot more interesting than if they just fail completely or they succeed completely. And in Tremulous, you have that potentiality to have what we term a partial success. Like you're trying to get away from the ghoul in the graveyard, but you don't quite do it. You don't get away clean, but you don't get devoured by the ghoul either. You might drop something out of your pocket, that sort of thing. So it's that gray area that I found really attractive for a horror type of game.
And also one of the other elements is, because it is a storytelling game, other people have tried to figure out that horror game element that is a little bit tough. I think horror, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think horror is very hard to run for any game master. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, that varies based upon your experiences, right?
Yeah. But
because I've been running horror games for over 30 years in some way, shape, or form. I was reading Lovecraft before Call of Cthulhu existed. So for me, it was natural. I've also been told, however, that I have a dark and twisted mind, so that might lend itself to that. But for a lot of people, yeah, they do have challenges. Just like I would have a challenge slam dunking a basketball, i.e. it would be impossible. But for a lot of folks, yeah, it is a challenge for the broad spectrum of gamers out there.
Well, okay, well, let me put it this way. Maybe not running so much, but I think it's the buy-in from the players that can be lacking, because maybe this is just me as a GM. Sometimes it's hard for me to sort of say, okay, look, this is what the guy you're playing should find spooky and scary. But that doesn't always seem to translate well. Sometimes it just doesn't come out quite right. Where I think storytelling games like Tremulous kind of allow the player to sort of build into it, do the lifting, so to speak, or the heavy lifting, so to speak, of adding into the story their own idea of what is scary here. And I think that's one of the strengths that Tremulous is really tapping into, is that the players, through their actions, which we can discuss here, even through their partial successes or their success, can sort of define what is this world. And then I think that in my experience as a playtesting is that I, as a player, or me as a GM, I will hear players, or I will give to the GM or the keeper in this case, here's what I think would be really frightening in this this spot without even really thinking about it.
Let's talk about that. That's a very valid question. It is hard to get player buy-in to a lot of these type of games.
Right.
Whether I've run Call of Cthulhu or Realms of Cthulhu or Agents of Oblivion to a lesser degree, it's hard to get people to invest and be creeped out. One of the interesting things that we've discovered in Tremulous is how ready the buy-in. People get invested in their characters in a very short time, and part of that is, speaking to what you just brought up, is helping to shape and create the dynamic of the story that we're telling together collaboratively. But I do want to point something out in case people are going, oh, they're not really getting into the game stuff, is that it is structured like a traditional role-playing game. A lot of people that are casually familiar with the term storytelling game think it's a little bit nebulous and loosey-goosey. There's no central game master. There aren't any really task resolution systems. It's all freeform, and that turns off the traditional role player.
Right.
Whereas in this, it has the players choose characters, which are playbooks that define whether they're a doctor, a detective, or a dilettante, that sort of thing. The keeper is still, if we use the term running the game, it's not entirely accurate. He's helping guide the players through an experience of a shared story. Would that be a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate way of putting it, yeah. And I think that's where it is interesting, because a lot of people, I've run this for people who are hardcore, they love the crunch of rules, and so far they've had a pretty positive experience to it, because you still roll for things, there's still a structure to the game. And I think that it's interesting that you sort of bring up the loosey-goosey element of storytelling games. I find another challenge on the other side of storytelling games is that if the player's not quite sure what to do, like, yeah, okay, you know, you wander into this barn, you know, what do you do? Or, you know, what's next? Because I need the player to help give back into the story, if it's storytelling, is that the rules allow for the player to, or it gives them the structure to sort of say, oh yeah, well, I want to ask this question, or I find this kind of thing, you know, what is it? And so that way they can sort of keep the story going. And so there's a structure for them to work from. So that way, if it's someone who's never played a open storytelling game like that, there's something there for them. There's a way to sort of funnel their thoughts into a structure to build into the game.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. I say that it's influenced by fate. That doesn't mean I brought actual mechanical elements over from the fate system. But one of the things that is intriguing about the fate game is the ability to make declarations.
Right.
And I've played and enjoyed various iterations of Fate, and I like the concept of declarations, but with some groups that I've played with, for people that are less familiar and conversant with those type of creative spaces, they sometimes stagger and hesitate. So with that particular move that you're talking about in Tremulous, which is called Poke Around, it allows them to do the creation of some new environmental things and gives them a finite space in which to do it. So they can be creative, but within a small area. And I've found no one has any problems with that.
No, I haven't found anyone. I think there's a slight learning curve at the beginning, like there would be of any game. But as soon as they figure out, it's like, oh, this is what I can do, you see that light turn on in their mind. And all of a sudden, I find that's when the creativity really starts flowing and the game story really gets interesting, which oddly enough is about 10 to 15 minutes into the game. There's that first dipping your toe into the water. But then, you know, the players are swimming at that point. As soon as that light switch turns on, the game really gets flowing.
Yes. I've seen it vary from about the 15 minutes. And for some people that are used to more traditional games, I've seen it take about 30 to 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But you can just tell when there's that shift of, oh, we're not playing like this. For an example, I ran one play test and there was a potential violent situation at hand. And when the person realized they had three options of how to deal with that combat, they really opened up. They really went, wow, this is not like those other games that I've played. I can do a lot of different stuff here. And then after about the 45-minute mark, the rules seem to just truly fade into the background. I know we hear that about a lot of games, right?
Right.
The rules fade into the background. But I've found it to really be the case with Tremulous. And I think you have from your experiences as well.
Yeah. I mean, I like I said, I think there is a slight need for reference sheet, which every game has. But you see some games' reference sheets, and I'm using plural there, go into pages and pages and pages of information. Where you're like, oh, okay, I need this specific situation. I got to flip to this page, or but for this game so far, the reference sheet is one page, and yeah, I mean, it just turns into once you get it, no problem from that point on. It's just it's really easy to grasp, and that's what's funny is that I mean, we can look at the current draft of the game, which how many words and pages are we up to now, Sean?
Oh, we're not going to say that.
Okay.
We never say that.
Okay, but more than 10 pages and more than, let's say, 500 words, right?
It's definitely more than... No, it's a streamlined document. How about that? We could say it's a streamlined document. And the reason that I'm hesitant about saying the exact number of pages is because of... Let's get technical for just a moment.
Oh, yeah, let's hear it.
No one turn off. This is going to get sexy here. Is... When you're writing in a Word document and then you're translating it over to another format, in this case, it's going to be a digest-sized book, and the style and everything is set, but essentially all those words that are going through last-minute massaging, but it's written and it's done and it's gone through multiple edits, it needs to be laid out into its final form, and that's going to take a while.
Yeah.
So I can't give an accurate word count.
So
I mean, I could give an accurate word count, but I can't give an accurate page count. And to many of our listeners, they're going to have no idea.
But I'm going to say this much to sort of go back to my point is that it's a pretty decent sized book. No matter what the end of layout is going to be, I'm not going to say how many pages I've seen because I've seen lots. But my point is that for a game that feels like it has so much heft to it in the book, it doesn't feel like... The game feels so easy to get into that it seems surprising to me sometimes when I look at that book, but every single bit of it is needed. There's not one part of it that you can sort of say, I don't need this. I can cut it out. It all weaves together very nicely, but
the reason for that is because I wanted to give lots of explanations and examples.
Sure.
So everything can be referenced in there. And as far as distilling the rules down to their essence, there's a playbook, which is an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that's printed in landscape format. And everything a player needs is on that sheet. On the back cover, because it would fold in half,
right.
The back cover has all the basic moves for the character. And it's basic moves that all the characters have. And then within it has places for their attributes and their lore, which we should get into in a moment.
We will.
And then on the right side, it has special moves unique to that character and their lore move and the special gear that that particular character would have or could opt to take going into the game.
Right. So let's talk about that. Let's get into the player aspect a little bit of this. So from the point of view of the players, they sit down and there is a stack of playbooks in front of them. Let's say this is they're playing a one shot with you.
Sure.
And sitting in front of them are these very playbooks that you talked about. And we sort of touched on this before, is that they're all kind of they're different types. You have the doctor, the dilettante. You sort of touched on them very briefly. But from there, once they pick their type of character they want to play, and this is another part that I think is interesting, is that when you first showed this to me, I was a little skeptical because I was like, well, wow, you're really kind of you're not giving me the chance like you wouldn't have in other games where you sit there and say, well, I'm going to play this guy and I'm going to make up this whole thing about him. And it's going to be a lot more interesting because I came up with him. But instead you sat there and said, well, here are your options. And I think in the core book, there are 10 or my
11,
11 options.
Everybody forgets the air.
That's right. The air, but everyone gets 11 options. And you sort of, like I said, you sort of get this, well, is this going to be really that interesting of a character for me? So I picked someone and then I started going through the options of, you know, just everything from gender to what kind of clothes he's wearing, what kind of equipment or stuff he has on him, equipment. And then I was like, okay, and you pick a name and you start, and then some of the character's specific moves. And then you start realizing, okay, this is kind of an interesting character. And you start forming in your head, who is this person? I think it's a really strong base for a good role-playing session specific to your character or your playbook in this case, because again, there's this structure, there's this foundation that you build up from. And the buildup is where the creativity comes into play. Every time I've played this, and unfortunately I have not played this as much as I'd like to, I've found like myself having a real connection to my character, my playbook. Because, you know, the keeper asks you the appropriate questions and really gets your buy-in for, you know, who are you? Which I think is brilliant versus, let's say I do another one shot with Mr. Sean Preston of Agents of Oblivion at a convention. You hand me a character sheet. Everything's written out there. I may care about the character on a story sense, but I really don't get invested in the character. Every experience I've had so far is everyone really gets invested into their playbook.
There's enough space where they can quickly do it. I've had experienced gamers like Ed Wetterman, who worked on Agents of Oblivion with me, and I ran a session for him, and he had the character done in 2 minutes.
Right.
And the backgrounds are loose enough where you can take them into whatever direction you want, the moves and everything. I've seen people play the same playbook in radically different ways because it's interesting because aside from choosing your stats and your looks and those things, when you get to your moves, when you look at it on the surface, it seems very simple. There are 5 moves that you can choose from specific to your character, and you start out with 2 of those 5 moves, and you also get a lore move. But those 2 moves really determine the type of character you're going to play. For example, you could play the detective, who is very much the well-connected thug type of detective, or you could play one that is more like Columbo or a monk who is very analytical and a little bit off maybe.
I think everyone's a little bit off in this game.
Yes.
Just a little bit.
I would agree. Just a little bit. Just enough to keep things interesting.
Now, sort of going to the next part for the players is let's discuss the town that they'll be in, which is Ebony Eves, correct?
Yes.
You can sort of play this different ways, which we'll talk about in a little bit here. But then if you're sort of playing this the traditional, quote unquote, way, is that you get to decide a lot about Ebony Eves itself, correct?
Yes, there are 2 series of questions, 7 questions in each series that define the local color, the composition of the town generally that the characters have heard about, and the town lore, which is the weirdness that they've heard about the town. Now, one of the basic philosophies of Tremulous is that the keeper is honest and generous in his answers to things. Well, that particular thing doesn't come into play with Ebony Eves. This is what the characters hear. So basically, after they've picked their characters and they're going through town creation, they're already really playing the game.
Right.
because they don't know. This is kind of rumor stuff. Like, are the townsfolk really friendly? Is it an old community? That kind of stuff. And there are 35 possible combinations for each side, for the town lore and the local color, which creates 1,250 combinations of possible towns. And there's information that's written for the players going into the town, and there's secret information for the keeper as to what is really going on beyond the scenes.
That is a huge amount of combination of material. I have not, this is the one part of the playtest or the document so far I have not seen myself. So this is something I'm really excited to see. And, you know, I from what I have heard, and I mean, you ran me through one game where we answered the question, you know, the group I was in, we answered the questions, and you just sort of like, okay, we hit the ground running. Here's the town, and it starts unfolding itself in front of you as you interact with the world, of course. I guess you could try to lock yourself in a room and, you know, but what kind of game would that be for you?
Right, right.
And so then the kind of next part is sort of let's talk about the keeper side of things, because obviously a small percentage of our listeners here or the people interested in this game will be on the keeper side, the GM side, if we haven't made clear what keeper means. So for the keeper, there's just as much amount of framework in place for you, the keeper, to do things. I mean, you are reacting to the players. And like I said, you're supposed to be generous to the players. I think you mentioned at one point the keeper is supposed to be, and I don't think I'm giving anything away here, this is actually really good philosophy or an idea, is the keeper is supposed to be a fan of the players, right?
Right.
He or she is supposed to be the one that's saying, yeah, great, you guys are doing this stuff. And if you ask me a question, I'm going to give you an honest answer. I'm not going to hide things from you unless maybe there's a partial success or failure involved.
Which is a big shift from other games that have dealt with Lovecraftian sort of things. And I've found in my experiences being honest and forthright, if anything, it's generated a lot more actual tension and fear in the players when they realize they find a scale and it's off of a deep one. And they know that it's off of a deep one instead of them having some type of conjecture.
Right. Where other games, the GM might penalize you for not having certain skills or knowledge already built into your character. Is that if let's face it, any game, even if you take one of your other games, like you said, Realms of Cthulhu, and I sit there and say, well, I ask, you know, what is this scale that I found? Oh, well, do you have any skill that would allow you to know that? Well, I'm going to heavily penalize you and you won't be able to figure that out, you know, unless you really roll amazingly. In this game, if the player rolls and says, and they want to figure out what is the scale, then the keeper says, yeah, this is from a deep one. And I find that really fascinating, because I guess it's something I never thought about doing myself as a GM. I always thought as part of the trick of being a GM or a keeper in any game is holding information back, trying to stretch out the information. But in this case, you're trying to hand it out as much as you can, or as much as the players will take it.
Well, and the reason for that is that there's always new things being generated. The players are the best ally of the keeper in this game, more so than lots of other games, because everybody who steps into the role of the keeper for the first time may feel a little tremulous themselves.
Yeah.
A little bit afraid of what's going on. But ultimately, when you realize that the players are doing a lot of the work, you can sit back and smile evilly. And you don't roll dice as the keeper, which is another thing. We should talk about moves a little bit. When a character wants to look around a barn.
Yeah.
Let's say we've got the dilettante. And despite not wanting to get her boots messed up, decides she's going to poke around in the barn. Well, she makes a roll for that. And this particular roll would be based on her luck. There are five attributes, basic attributes in Tremulous, luck being one of them. And as everyone will tell you, no attribute is a throwaway attribute. They are all important on some degree or another.
Yes.
So let's say the dilettante is looking around the barn. And that's a move that she takes. So she's actually poking around and she makes her roll.
Okay.
Let's say she rolls a 3. So she rolls badly. Well, the keeper gets to hold one to use as a hard move. And this is how the keeper does things. Since the keeper doesn't roll any dice, which is kind of weird, you're going to think, well, I'm not going to be doing anything if I'm not rolling dice. Entirely wrong. Being able to take those holds and just do things is pretty amazing. So let's say the Keeper's feeling a little bit malicious because the Dilettante has been prancing around, defeating all his big bad guys. That when she's poking around in the barn and she rolls this 3 and he gets to hold one, he can save it for later, but decides to go ahead and use it now. So when she's poking around the barn, she knocks over a lantern and catches the barn on fire. That's a hard move, right? And she's suddenly trapped in the barn.
Right.
Because he's separated her.
Yes.
So that's the type of move that the Keeper can take. And what's interesting is that players know that when they make a mistake, when they roll poorly, that there's a consequence. And I haven't had one player at all grouse at any of the horrible, horrible things that I have done to them because they know that that's how this game works.
Right.
So you can actually really structure in other games where you'd have to make some rolls for this and that. This, it just happens, and it's a testament to the strength of the underlying system. It's just a lot of fun. I'm sure you've experienced that same type of thing when you're running the game.
I have. I think it's been interesting because, you know, one of the things you don't want to do is sort of explain what are the moves I'm using against you. But one of the, as a keeper, and I've run a few games now, one of the psychological games I play against players is that every time they have a miss on a roll, if I know I can hold a hard move against them later, I make a mark. I make a little scratch by their name on the piece of paper I'm using to keep track of what the players are doing in front of me. And if they ask, I tell them, it's like, well, you know, you're sort of building up bad luck against you when these things happen. So just know. And then when it happens to them, they know it's coming. And yeah, so far I've had not one single person go, well, that's really unfair. You know, how dare you just sort of say this is going to happen? No, they know it. And I think that is another element that builds that suspense, is this knowing. It's like, oh, every time I've had some players just the other last week I was playing this. Someone just kept failing. Within the first 30 minutes, I had 6 hard moves held up against them. Just 6 scratches on their piece of paper in front of their name. And he was just like, oh man, my night's just going to get worse. And it became a dread that every time something happened, he was like, is this it? Oh, you know, and it builds up that suspense. So yeah, I think that's a great way of doing things.
And it should be added that the Keeper is still also able to take moves when the players are kind of looking at the Keeper for what to do next. So the Keeper's constantly taking moves. He's not just accumulating moves in that regard.
Yeah.
But it's a very interactive back and forth all along. And it sounds very mechanized when you're listening or looking at it from the outside, but it plays remarkably well. I call it a mechanized narrative.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate description of it. Because sometimes especially if you're new to this kind of thing, everyone needs a little help with these type of games. This is not... While it's easy to pick up and easy to play, sometimes you will. I've gotten stuck a couple times as the Keeper going, oh, oof, you know, the players are kind of not making a move and I need to do something and they're looking to me to move the story. It helps to have those mechanics in the background to sort of lean against and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do next, to give you inspiration to move forward.
Because you're supposed to keep their lives interesting. Doesn't always mean evil or bad, but interesting. Because I've run a game where a person was playing by themselves. They were playing the Librarian, which is one of the stretch goal playbooks. And she was just going about her business kind of holed up in the library. And the mayor came storming in, and he's very much a time is money type of individual. And so I made her life interesting without any direct mytho stuff. The town is strange. One of the things I say to folks is like an elevator pitch is it's Twin Peaks meet Stephen King by way of H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes.
So if you're familiar with any kind of weird stuff or scary stuff, you don't have to be an expert in Lovecraft. You just have to really know what scares you and what scares your friends. And when you get going, people are going to say the things that scare them. Like, oh, I'm glad that that's not the head of a doll and it's just the head of a coyote. And then you'll be thinking, doll will have to appear somewhere in the story.
Yes. I did that to someone who she actually shouted out, I don't want to get too deep into the story, but they found some shed skin, like a sleeve of shed skin, like a snake would leave behind.
Right.
And she blurted out, and just as I was about to say it, honestly, because I was like, okay, well, it's going to be in the shape of a forearm and a hand. So it looks like a skin glove, basically. And she was like, oh, please don't let there be a hand on the end of that. you know, a shape of a hand. And I said, hey, look at that, a shape of a hand. And she just, I was like, wow, you really are telegraphing to me what you would find frightening. I didn't say that to her, but I was like, it's really interesting that someone would announce to the keeper, it's like, please, please don't let this be that, you know?
Well, like when I ran the sessions for the person that hadn't played role-playing games, she was conversant with Lovecraft and Cthulhu stuff. And she crept upstairs into this restricted book area. As the librarian, she had the key. And she is wandering around, and she sees this one part of the library in the attic that has lots of sigils and signs, and it is curved. And she says, oh, God, I hope there's not a Hound of Tyndalus around here. And I grinned gleefully, because up until that point, there probably would not have been an introduction of a hound anywhere into the story.
Right. But at that point, you just decided, well, time to introduce the hound.
Well, there was a dark sorcerer that had been brought back from the dead, so it was natural that there should be a hound familiar for him at that point, right?
Yeah. So let's ask one more thing about the keeper side of things, because we talked about the Ebon Eve's creation, which is, you know, the series of questions we talked about before, which I think lends itself more towards a campaign, because then you can really build up the story based on the little bit of information. Well, actually, it's quite a bit, but it's not enough to just sort of say, oh, well, here's your entire game. But it is enough to build from. But on the other hand...
Let me jump into that. Sure. Having written that and run a bunch of that is... What it does is we should talk about frameworks as well. So we'll get into that through the Ebon Eve's direction.
And that's what I was coming to next. So this is perfect.
Right. That's right. It's like the skin glove, right?
Perfect.
There's a hand at the end.
So roll it.
So the town creation, on the keeper side, it's generating sets of hazards. And these hazards create a framework.
Right.
And the hazards are basically the bad things. Things that the characters are going to encounter that's going to cause them problems some way, shape, or form. Like you can have elder hazards, which are people important in the town. Like the mayor. It could be anybody, though. It could be the milkman, little Johnny down the street. You could have weird hazards, which could be Miss Peterson, who's secretly a cannibal, who is running your boarding house. She looks nice on the surface, however, comma, dot, dot, dot. You can have mythos hazards, and you can have landscape hazards, and all these sorts of kind of things going on. And each of those types of hazards have specific moves that they can take. Like an elder hazard can take a certain type of move that a townies, which is like a mob of people or whatever, for example, townies could be the coal miners that work in the local mine. They're a group that the characters are going to have a conflict with somewhere down the line.
Right.
But the hazards create frameworks. So having run an extended amount of play using Ebon Eve's is using the frameworks. We generated well over 30 hours of play, and only one of the two threads was resolved.
Wow.
After 30 hours of play. So it lends itself well. So that's another thing we should point out before we jump back to frameworks, is that when most people think storytelling games, and I am guilty of that as well, or have been, you think it's a one-shot game.
Right.
Which isn't a bad thing. Fiasco is one of my favorite games, and that was the inspiration for doing Ebon Eve's. I really liked those discrete elements that Jason put into the game, and you got to play with them in your head. And so I liked that idea, and that's what I was bringing over when I did the creation of Ebon Eve's. Let's take these parts, and you get combinations that are just really bizarre, but they always seem to work out.
Right. So the ability to create a one-shot, or the ability to create... let's say a convention, a convention game, sure, something like that. Because I think this is something people will find interesting. You really aren't putting, you're not really burning that many calories to make this framework, story.
I want to jump in on this.
Sure.
Because I'm going to take over the mantle and ask you a few questions.
Okay.
On this particular thing.
Sure.
I'm going to set up the frameworks. When I built the framework structure of the game.
Yes.
I was curious how long it was going to take to create a framework.
Correct.
And the framework is putting together different hazards and linking them together and creating hazard tracks, which we'll discuss in a moment. I'll let you discuss the hazard tracks because I really like the Child of Sin framework you put together. And that's what I'm going to ask you about in just a moment.
Okay.
So you build, take these hazards and you build them together. And the first time I did this, I'm like, this looks good on paper. Theoretically, this should work.
Right.
So I set the timer. I don't run around setting timers as a general rule, but I said, if I'm going to be talking about this with any degree of accuracy, I need to set the clock.
Sure.
So the first time I went through it, it took about 15 to 20 minutes
okay.
for me to do that. And that generated 6 to 8 hours of play. In that particular instance, it generated 6 hours of play from the first framework. And it told an entire story. And it really blew my mind how well that it worked.
Yeah.
And for those listening, I was telling Justin my story about this. And I met what one might say would be a degree of skepticism. Would that be accurate, Justin?
Yes. I would say that is accurate.
So now I'd like you to tell me about your story, because I challenged you to set the clock and do the same thing that I did.
Yes. And I followed the guidelines you laid out, sort of answering and creating questions. It's kind of an interesting process.
Oh, I should jump in and say one thing. I didn't give Justin any information. It's not like Justin and I talked about any of the stuff. I just said, read what I wrote and run with it.
You literally, I think, gave me the page 1 hour before this when you told me what you did. And so I had enough time to sort of skim it over as you were telling me things. And yeah, this is where I became skeptical because I have, and I'll admit this to you and to our listeners, I have seen this tried in other games, even by you, Sean. And I've always sort of go, yeah, this is all right. You know, it gives you enough to sort of build a game, but there's really a lot of work you have to do after that. And it still takes an amount of time. So you said, Justin, go ahead and build this. And I said, all right. And I'll set the timer. So I went through the process, answered the questions, built the framework, put in some questions that, you know, the unknowns that you sort of described it, like some questions about it, and then the different hazard tracks. And it took me, I think it, when I hit the stop on the stopwatch where I said, okay, I'm done, it was 22 minutes. And then I actually played this 2 days later. I already ran this for a few of my friends, and it was a 4-hour game, and it's not anywhere near done. So I ended up creating a Ebon Eves, and that there was a farm owned by the Vilcomps. And nice. I don't want to give away too much just in case any of my players are listening, but there was a creature there that was called, well, no one officially called it this, but I called it the Child of Sin. And it was this giant misshapen being, a human, but very strange looking, who would find girls that he found attractive near at the nearby college, Ebon Eves University, who would wander by the farm. If he fell in love with them, he would track them down and take them away and then end up hugging them to death by accident. And so the family would have to cover up the deaths. But yeah.
It shows you're a sick, sick man. So what do you think coming away from that, besides your mental illness that we're now outing the airwaves? So what do you think? Are you convinced now? Did it seem like a one-time thing, or do you feel comfortable that you could do this over and over?
I have discovered, since you have planted this into my head, this game, and building threads or frameworks, is that I have been taking concepts, like just ideas I get, writing them down, and I have been building more. Just frameworks. No story, nothing else, just the basic frameworks that I can hopefully always have on hand. I'm starting to make a little book of them. So that way, if someone says, hey, I want to play Tremulous, and they're, you know, a game just comes up and gets started, I have something to run. So I have built several now. And I think the longest one that I had to go back and rewrite, and that took me 35 minutes because I was like, there's something here I'm not happy with. So I sort of restructured it.
Yeah, we should say that you can certainly spend more than 15 or 20 minutes if you want to. I know some of our playtesters have spent hours because some folks want to mull over the finer details, and that's totally cool. That just, it works towards your play style.
Yes.
And we hope to have a repository for these once the book is out in the wild where people can share their frameworks on our website. So I think that would be kind of cool for you to put that one up there after your guys play through it and go mad and all that sort of thing. But let's talk about this. This is kind of interesting because the kind of story you told me doesn't sound like there's any tentacles or cultists. What's up with that?
Yeah, it was very strange. It was just a family who had a given birth to a misshapen child that was just a freak. So yeah, no tentacles, nothing, no cultists, nothing like that. But I felt wove together a very compelling Lovecraft-like story out of it. Or at least I was told I did.
Yeah, and that's the thing we should probably hit on a little bit. I think we've talked enough to let people know that frameworks are good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
The reason it was called a storytelling game of Lovecraftian horror, the Lovecraftian part of it, we should really emphasize, is that Lovecraft told a lot of stories that weren't just Cthulhu rising out of the water.
No, definitely.
He told a lot of quieter stories like the rats in the wall, dreams in the witch house.
Yes.
Stories that were weird and funky and fundamentally disturbing.
Yes.
And this is hitting that space. This is exploring a space. And I've said this multiple times, but I'll say it on here. It's all about telling human stories within human elements. It feels grittier. The people feel more human. They're special. Everybody that's playing one of the playbooks, instead of playing a librarian or a dilettante, they're playing the librarian or the dilettante or the drifter or the sorcerer. Yeah, I just teased out a few things in some upcoming playbooks that aren't in the core book in there. But they're playing a special, unique individual that has somehow brushed up against weirdness somewhere along the way, which gives them a lore move.
Right, which just leads into another part of the playbooks. The lore moves, which makes every playbook just a little bit special, doesn't it?
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the lore move. In lots of traditional games, it's usually the professor. Lots of Cthulhu-type games, it's the professor or the antiquarian that's the one running around reading the books, the one trying to figure things out so they can eventually learn the ritual to stop the cultist from putting down the great evil, right?
Right.
And that is a style of game you can play with Tremulous, certainly. But one of the things that this does, lore becomes a currency in this game where it's important for each and every character because it enables them to fuel their lore move.
Right.
For example, and each of those is really something that, you know, all the characters start with this particular lore move, and it gives them that special little something that sets them apart. And it makes them puzzling things out just as much of a driver as it does for the professor. For example, let's use the detective. So the detective is a pretty straightforward playbook, right?
Yes, very much so.
And yeah, and that's a good one. They're all solid, but that's a really probably one of the more introductory playbooks, I would say. So the lore move that the detective gets is if he has some lore, he can spend a point of lore to play a hunch. And by expending that point of lore, that means that gives him, he picks an NPC, whichever NPC. It could be the grocer. It could be little Johnny who we're picking on down the street.
Right.
But he can spend that point of lore, which means when he's trying to figure things out about Johnny, anything to do with Johnny, he's going to get a +1 on his rolls as the story progresses, which is a pretty big deal.
And I think that's where it becomes interesting because that seems like, oh, I only get the one lore move. But like you said, that's a big deal because that can help feed into another part of the story that the keeper wasn't expecting and the player wasn't expecting maybe. And thus keep building on that hopefully very wonderful, very scary story that you're building here in Ebenezer.
Well, yeah, let's take that from another angle. Let's say that you're playing the detective.
Okay.
And little Johnny's in the yard next door to Miss Peterson, whom the keeper knows is actually the cannibal lady. But you're certain something is up with Johnny. Johnny's about 12, and every time you're in the yard, he's peering through the fence at you.
Right.
So you decide that you're going to play a hunch on Johnny, not Miss Peterson, who is gleefully cleaning the bones in her sewing room. And you play this hunch on Johnny. Well, you're telegraphing to me as the keeper that Johnny is important. So suddenly Johnny's tied up in something. It may not be directly related to Miss Peterson's cannibalistic shenanigans, but something is now going to be going on with Johnny.
Right. Thus causing you, the keeper, to respond by saying, well, maybe Johnny's helping out, or maybe Johnny is, well,
leading, emulating her.
Maybe he's emulating her, yeah.
Practicing on mutilating animals.
We are healthy-minded people when we come up with these things. But I don't think we want to give away too much more today.
Sure.
So maybe I don't know. Is there anything else you want the listener out there, the person who might be interested in kickstarting this, or just interested in Tremulous itself? Is there anything else you would like to say to the listeners?
Yeah. Sorry that we did a lousy job of pushing it in a very Amway fashion. And we just kind of talked about it. I'm not a hard sell type of guy. I think the product, whatever it is, as with Tremulous, should speak for itself. But we'd love everybody to play this game, help us kickstart it. And we've got some really, really neat stretch goals.
Yes.
For this. So I can really only emphasize that by throwing some money into the bin, that there's going to be a lot of neat stuff coming out for Tremulous.
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to thank everybody for listening to the inaugural RazorWise report.
Yes, definitely. Thank you for having me on.
You're absolutely welcome. And everyone, play Tremulous, tell your friends, and help spread the madness. Until next time, this is Sean Preston of the RazorWise Report. Dun, dun, dun.